Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
It's Wednesday, September 12th, 2012, and this is KBIA's Views of the News, our weekly examination of the news media and their impact on the public. I'm Mike McKean, Futures Lab Director at the Reynolds Journalism Institute and Missouri School of Journalism Professor. Joining me are J-School faculty colleagues and regular analysts Lee Wilkins and Charles Davis. Our topics this week: the New York Times publishes an editorial, not a news story, saying there's new evidence the Bush administration failed to act on intelligence warnings before the 9/11 terrorist attacks. Meanwhile, news organizations are debating what's the right amount of 9/11 coverage now that we're 11 years beyond the attack. What words do young people use to describe the news? According to a new scholarly book, here are a disturbing few: garbage, lies, propaganda, and boring. And American newspapers are losing $25 in print advertising for every dollar they gain in digital sales. The problem isn't with online advertising per se. It's growing rapidly in some corners, just not for newspapers. Well, let's start with yesterday's 11th anniversary of the 9/11 terrorist attacks and what may or may not have been big news yesterday, though it appeared on the editorial page rather than the news pages of the New York Times. Former Times reporter Kurt Eichenwald penned the editorial, saying he had access to unreleased presidential briefings. Eichenwald argues that the Bush administration was negligent in not heeding intelligence agency warnings that an al-Qaeda attack on American soil was imminent. Could the 9/11 attack have been stopped? Eichenwald says, quote, "We can't ever know." Bush defenders went ballistic. They noted Eichenwald's book on the terror wars had been published that very day. Former White House spokesman Ari Fleischer accused the author of seeking partisan retribution in a face-off last night on CNN's Anderson Cooper 360.
Maybe he's smarter and sharper than everybody, Democrat, Republican, who served on that 9/11 commission. I don't think so.
Ari is either willing to throw out information he has no idea what he's talking about, or he's willing to lie. Every single time Ari hears a fact he doesn't like, it's partisan.
And Eichenwald also took umbrage with Fleischer's tweets earlier in the day, where he said the author was just like the truthers who believe President Bush knew in advance of the attacks and let them happen anyway. Well, the first question, I guess, Charles, is this was news story, you'd argue. I mean, if there was something new in this, why was it on the editorial page rather than in the news pages of the New York Times?
Well, I would imagine it was on the editorial pages because Eichenwald is no longer an employee. He's a former New York Times reporter, and he alone had access to the information that he based the story on. And so when you have that sort of, I don't even know what you'd call him, guest writer, he has a very interesting relationship with the Times, then probably the place you open up for him is the op-ed page. The story itself was written in an opinionated tone. I mean, it wasn't a piece of news reportage, except for the basis of it, which very much was.
I mean, I guess my argument, Lee, is not with the column itself, although some people obviously did think that there was a problem with it. It's that if there was anything new to it, especially on 9/11, the day of the anniversaries, why don't you set it up so that you interview him, that you do a story, you ask other people for their background? And yet Margaret Sullivan, who's the new public editor at the Times, she went around and asked folks, and she said, well, you know, I think it's well-trod ground. She talked to one of their national security reporters, and he said, there are no new secret documents, no revelations that knock your socks off. So which is it? Is it news or isn't it?
I don't know, which argues to me that you put it on the opinion page and let people read it for themselves and then make a determination. I agree with Charles. I mean, I read it beginning to end. Most of it read like investigative reporting to me. There were some, you know, there were some things at the beginning. There was an opinion at the end, no doubt about that. But, you know, the rest of it says, these are the documents. This is what the documents say. The other thing about it is, I mean, I do think that part of the other reason that it went on the editorial page is because it was indeed in its own way a shameless plug for the book that was released the very same day. And I don't know how you get around that other than to say, this is an opinion, folks, and it's going to make somebody money and cue in your readers in that sense.
I suppose, though, I would just say that the New York Times staff either thought that this was worthy of publishing, the editors, or it wasn't. And if it was worth publishing, if there was something new to be said, and it appears that he had access to documents others didn't, why not do a full-blown news story about
it? Well, I think maybe because Eichenwald was in possession of the documents, and he said, this is the way I want to do it.
Yeah.
I want op-ed space so that I can plug my book.
Great. Then if you're not going to show me the documents or prove you have access to them, then we're not giving you any space, even though you're a former New York Times reporter.
Yeah, see, I think the relationship with Eichenwald is pretty special because he shared lots and lots and lots of documents with the Times as a reporter, including the NSA domestic eavesdropping documents. He also currently and maybe in the future will face retribution from the administration for confidential sources. So he's also a remarkably courageous reporter in that he's doing this even as that sickle hangs over his head.
I don't know about that. I mean, he certainly hopes to make plenty of money off of this book and the timing of it. I mean, we would all do the same thing. If we had a book coming out, we would try to time it so we could get the maximum audience for the topic. But I don't know. Courageous is the word I would use. I'll say Ari Shapiro wasn't terribly courageous either in his defense of the Bush administration. What he did is he went back to the 9/11 Commission report and just kept waving that around, saying that there were plenty of failures and lessons learned, Lee, but that there really was no conclusion in the 9/11 report that the White House was somehow negligent. He also trotted out that really kind of ugly tweet about how Eichenwald was just like the truthers.
Okay, so let's get rid of the tweet. I'm not a big Ari Shapiro fan, but in this, I think he has at least a corner on the truth. I did read the 9/11 Commission report. It's been a while. But indeed, there was plenty of blame to pass around. And the fact that any president doesn't have a crystal ball that gives you 100% certainty about events that are going to happen within the next 12 hours, or the next 24 hours, or the next year, I'm sorry, nobody gets that kind of prognostication ability. So in that sense, I think he was right. I think Eichenwald is also right to go ahead and publish what he thinks he knows. This will now become a debate for historians, which is what I think it should be. I think it also informs the current political debate, which is what I also think it should do.
By the way, Charles, my apologies to a very fine NPR reporter, Ari Shapiro. It's Ari Fleischer, the former White House spokesman.
Sorry.
Now, Eichenwald didn't mention, and this was another one of Fleischer's criticism, he didn't mention in, quote, the context that he allegedly should have used, the fact that the Clinton administration was also accused of hearing all kinds of warnings that they didn't act upon. Was it somehow his obligation to provide that context in an editorial?
No, because that context has been provided every single time that the Bush administration wants to respond to any critics. What was newsworthy about this to me was the fact that Eichenwald made the point very well in the column. It wasn't the one memo that said Al-Qaeda determined to attack America. That was the one the Bush administration selectively released, right? Very selectively released to say, see, this is all we knew, when in fact he found out that there were days and days of increasingly shrill memoranda, a couple of which were really quite bold in their assertions that an attack was imminent, quote unquote. At the end of the day, yeah, the blame game gets really old, but this is fascinating history, and these documents, which should have all been released for the American people to work through themselves, are really telling.
I wonder about this criticism, Lee, from some folks that, well, this was an important story, and certainly if we had all the documents, it would be an even bigger story, but why release it on 9/11? This is a day when we're very somberly reflecting on the events that occurred 11 years ago, and this shouldn't be a day for partisanship, quote unquote. What do you think of that argument?
Well, I don't. It's a little bit hard for me to buy because whether or not it's a day for partisanship, I don't know. Partisanship has become this giant maw. And if you don't like something, you throw everything into it. But if it truly is a day for reflection, then what better day to publish a story like this that tries to look analytically and critically about how one, I emphasize one element of American government behaved in the run-up to what became 9/11. I mean, I, honestly, for me, I can't see a day that was more appropriate because the nation, which is bothered by everything from Kim Kardashian to goodness knows what else, for that one moment there, we're all kind of back 11 years ago and we're thinking about this again. So this was a teachable moment. Yes, you do it now.
And Ari Fleischer decrying partisanship. I mean, come on. Ari Fleischer would be partisan on Christmas. This is a guy who, in the wake of September 11th, if we recall, warned Americans about what they write and say when people were critical of American foreign policy. So, I mean, we got to take this stuff with a huge grain of salt. He's a partisan attack dog.
Lee, I hate to say it, but we will be bringing up the Kardashians in just a moment in relationship to this very
Sorry, trying to segue
story.
Here.
But first I want to talk about the fact that the New York Times got it both ways yesterday. They and the New York Post and the Wall Street Journal all came under some criticism from some quarters because they didn't publish a 9/11 anniversary story on the front page. And we're going to show you a graphic here as a fact of other papers, such as the New York Daily News and Newsday. They devoted their entire covers, again, to it. Well, that begs the question, what obligation do news organizations have as each one of these anniversaries pass and we move farther and farther away from the actual historical event? And I wonder what you think of that, Lee, the fact that at least some newspapers decided it's time to cover other news on the front page.
I think all those decisions are okay, which is one of the things I like about the web is if you don't like what the New York Times did and you want to find your anniversary story, you can go and find it someplace else. I also think that it's important for us to tell our audience that we're reporting this in the morning when we've had some events that make us realize that the shadow of 9/11 goes very far forward in not just American history, but in global history. And so one of the things is, well, do you second guess your colleagues? I don't know. I'm glad the New York Times did what it did. I am glad other papers did what they did. I think there was room for lots of choices here, none of them horribly right or horribly wrong.
Charles, what's your take on it?
Well, these sorts of events become history. I mean, over time, they become distant history. And when they do, I think they do get a little gauzy. I mean, think about D-Day, for example. Think about Pearl Harbor. I mean, these are events that when I was growing up were equally lionized. I can remember front page coverage of Pearl Harbor anniversaries in my youth. They're not front page news anymore, right? So, I mean, the news agenda crowds out events as history moves on. This is a special, iconic day. It always will be. Americans will always mourn the loss of American life in September 11th, but yes, it will become less of a front page news event with the passage of time, and I think it probably should.
But even with Pearl Harbor, the closest thing we have to this kind of story in the recent past, I suppose, I mean, that war ended. I mean, the Japanese became our allies. The war on terror, or whatever phrase you want to use to describe it, goes on today. I mean, it's still current.
It is still current, but I'm not sure. Okay, this is me giving my personal opinion, and it's not really mediated. It's I'm not sure that 9/11 captures any longer the war on terror in totality so much as it captures a portion of the war on terror, a specific event, maybe the event when this country more than some others had to wake up. And yes, we do mourn the loss of life, not just the loss of American life, but the loss of life, period. But when you think about, you know, well, Iraq and then Afghanistan and how much that war echoes on through, I'm not sure that framing it only in the substance of 9/11 really does justice to the story itself.
Yeah. And Charles Lee mentioned the fact that she was glad that different news organizations took different approaches. I wonder if there's anything to be said, maybe it's just obvious, that some publications, especially those news organizations that are covering local news in the New York, New Jersey area, would treat it differently even 5 or 10 years from now than, say, a national publication that just happens to be based in New York, like the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times.
That's true. I mean, you're going to get the diversity in terms of localization of the story. You're going to get the diversity in terms of sort of how it's treated, whether it's a feature story, whether it's a news story. A lot of it depends on how many events are happening in your own backyard pertaining to September 11th. Watching KOMU last night, there was coverage of the events that took place in town. And so it's not as if a lot of the critics look to the national media for their example when there's a lot of meaningful coverage that's taking place right in their backyard.
Right. Well, the Times wasn't the only news outlet that stirred up a hornet's nest by downplaying the anniversary. NBC came in for even more grief because of a questionable call. While the other TV networks and cable channels were all airing the annual moment of silence when the first plane hit the World Trade Center, here's what they were doing over at the Today Show.
In just a moment, President Obama and the First Lady, Michelle Obama, will observe a moment of silence.
Back now at 8:45 with Kris Jenner, the matriarch of the Kardashian clan, as both a mom and a manager, or a momager, as they like to say. She is guiding the careers of her six kids while trying to set limits for her youngest daughters, Kylie and Kendall, who are still finishing high school. Kris, good morning.
Good morning.
Keeping up with you is hard to do. You guys are so busy.
It's a little busy right now. Yeah, we just finished filming season 7 of Keeping Up with the Kardashians, so we're just coming to the end of that, and it's crazy.
We can thank the folks at the New York Magazine for putting together the video clip we've been watching, which showed side by side what was on the Today Show and the other networks. You can clearly hear the bells tolling and later taps playing while Savannah Guthrie talks to Kris Jenner about her boob job. Megan Kopp, an NBC spokesperson, told Politico in defense of all of this, the Today Show dedicated a considerable amount of time to September 11th coverage this morning throughout the entire show. Lee, good enough excuse?
Nope.
Well, say a little more than nope. Why?
I mean,
maybe it's obvious, but why?
Okay. The obvious part is, yeah, show a little respect. The less obvious part is that this is what's happened to the Today Show, and it's tragic that a show that used to do at least some news in the morning and at least some other things has now just descended into celebrity whatnot and basically into shameless plugs that are never articulated as shameless plugs because, of course, the Kardashians air on, what do I want to call it, a sister sister media organization to NBC owned by the same corporate parent. They have no excuse. They should apologize to everybody. And everybody involved, including Ms. Kardashian, should have known better.
I think REM said it best. It's the end of the world as we know it. they had the entire morning. As they said, we dedicated substantial resources. Well, how about moving some of those resources to the ultimate moment of the entire morning's coverage instead of doing it at 6:10 a.m.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, there were a couple of interesting stories yesterday, I thought, that were pointing out that social media, YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, they didn't exist, of course, on September 11th, 2001. And wondering whether or not they might have made a difference in how we learned about that event and what we felt about the attacks. And I'm curiously what you think about that.
I think they would have made a difference in how we learned about the event for sure. My memory of 9/11 was that I saw the plane hit the first building and thought, is this a movie? And then I saw the plane hit the second building. And then I had this conversation with myself about do I call my daughter, who was a freshman in college in Texas, or do I let it ride? And I decided that not calling was the better route. And about 30 minutes later, she called me. I don't think that Facebook could have replaced that phone call where she got to hear what my voice sounded like and I got to hear how worried and frightened she really had become.
Well, I think it would have been very different in my experience, at least, because I was pushing a kid at preschool on a swing set and had been for about 20 or 30 minutes when somebody came up to me and interpersonally told me the news. I did not have a phone in my pocket and did not know. I can't imagine a news event of that magnitude taking place now and not finding out through a text or a tweet within nanoseconds.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I had my kids at the bus stop getting ready to go to school that day. I must say, though, I can imagine in some very useful and some very painful ways how it'd be different if we had people with their cell phones taking pictures and sharing them from ground zero. And I mean, there's an awful lot that would have been different today if we had that kind of disaster. Well, let's move on to another topic. It seems like every few weeks a new study comes out with some depressing findings for the news business. And this week it comes from the University of Texas, where Professor Paula Poindexter has just published a new book called Millennials, News and Social Media. Poindexter conducted a national survey of Americans born in the 80s and 90s. She asked them, among other things, to describe mainstream news reporting. Some of the words they used were these: garbage, lies, one-sided, propaganda, repetitive, boring. Those are some pretty damning indictments from those young people, wouldn't you say, Lee?
I think they're pretty damning indictments, but as usual, and since both, I think all three of us know Professor Poindexter, I'm going to say, mm-hmm. you know, bravo to you for doing this work. But I'm curious as to what the same group of people would say about the average Facebook post, whether some of those words would come up as well. I know they come up on ratemyprof.com, so this may just be a way of venting a little bit of spleen. I also think that the way that she phrased the question is really interesting because I'm curious as to how those young people would define mainstream news reporting. I don't know whether that, for example, does or does not include Fox. I don't know if it includes or doesn't include the New York Times. What about Jon Stewart or even Jay Leno? I mean, if you put this survey in context with others, one of the things we know is that this group of kids gets, they're kids to me, gets a lot of its news from late night comedians. So does that make them the mainstream news media?
Yeah, and in her news release for her new book, which is just coming out, since we're talking about new books and controversies today, she didn't spell that out. Now, probably in the book it does, and I haven't at least had a chance to read that book, so maybe we'll find out. But those sort of buzzwords in the lead, of course, were drawing us in, but some of the conclusions she drew, I think, are also interesting for us to consider. She said that most millennials feel that traditional media don't cover their generation well. Most of them use smartphones, apps, and social media to find out what's going on in the news. They don't depend on the news as much to help with their daily lives. And one that I found that was maybe the most controversial, Charles, is that at least according to her conclusions, millennials don't feel that being informed is important.
Yeah, that one struck me as deeply troubling. Also, though, a little, I think there's a disconnect there because I think what these people are reacting to, these young millennials, is the very information diet in which they live, right? They're talking about the water in their own aquarium. I mean, they are on social media all day consuming what? Curated news media links. So maybe if you get them to talk about individual content, it might be very different instead of the institution of news gathering, which, as we know, a lot of millennials don't like institutions, period. And so if you ask them to fill in the blanks about any institution, you get negative, negative, negative. And then when you get them to sort of poke a little bit harder about actual stuff, what's behind those links you're getting on Twitter? Oh, yeah, that's news. Right, I see.
Lee, do you think that young people really don't think it's important for them to keep current?
I think keep current is a really interesting phrase because I think they keep current about things that I have decided for ill or good are not worth keeping current about. The Kardashians, in my case, being a good example. The other side of it is that this is a generation you can see interviewed all the time of this generation that is very concerned about where's my job? When do I get out of my parents' basement? You know, all of those kinds of things. So when they say that the traditional news media doesn't cover them and their generation, I think there's a little bit of, I want to say, in the box, out of the box kind of thinking, because I certainly see some of those stories, even if they don't.
Some of the comments that popped up on Romanesco, Jim Romanesco had this on his blog, the story, were kind of predictable, I suppose. There were some young people who were saying, hey, we're not really like that. But then the one that I find particularly sort of not helpful and predictable was some old-time journalists who were saying basically, well, you know, when they have a kid and a mortgage, they'll start paying attention to news. That it's really their fault, not the fault of the news media for not catering to them.
That's the old graying theory of mass media consumption, which the newspaper industry rode right into its demise, right? The idea that, oh, no, our readers will come as they age, and then at one point they didn't. I think we'd better be very careful about that assumption that people will grow into their interest in the news. Now, that having been said, we're in an odd place, obviously. I mean, we have to think outside the university to the broader market because our students are hyper-informed. I mean, our students are riding curated news content literally 24 hours a day. And so we see the absolute other end of the continuum.
We see that end of the continuum. We see students in that age group who literally describe themselves as NPR junkies, you know, the oldest and fogiest, if you will. But I also think, I mean, there's wisdom and there's stupidity in that comment. As people go through different stages of life, their concerns do become different. And that's very important for the news industry, whether it's newspaper or broadcast television or what have you, to count on that as a way of erasing what will be decades-old habits of not paying for news and not paying attention to news used in the traditional sense. That's just dumb.
Well, when Professor Poindexter talks about her remedies for this situation, I mean, they're not necessarily new ideas either, but let's talk about them for a second. She says that we need to have much more news literacy training for young people. And also, you know, again, we need to make the news more engaging. And I know we all talk about that word, whatever it means. Let's talk about literacy for a second, though, Charles. How important and how feasible is it for us to do more of that?
I totally agree with Paula there. I think, and the School of Journalism here at Missouri is starting to make some real efforts around literacy, and I cannot be more excited about it. I think we have a responsibility as a school of journalism to the broader public, not only the university public, but the capital P public, to start helping people learn how to engage with news, because I think we just assume people know. And the more complex and diverse the news ecosystem becomes, the more difficult it is to access. I mean, that sounds ironic, because all you got to do is get on the internet. Not true. I mean, if you haven't read and you're not involved in the narrative of news, it can be very confusing. And so we've got to help people break it down and make sense of it. And I underscore her findings there.
Well, whether or not news, as this survey suggests to young people, is boring or repetitive or propaganda or whatever, clearly newspapers, at least, are still in a deep economic hole for some reason or another. Data recently released by the Newspaper Association of America, for example, shows that the collapse of traditional print advertising has not been overcome by online revenues. In fact, for every dollar that a paper currently earns from digital ads, it's losing $25 in print ads. And Lee, obviously, that's just not sustainable.
Well, it's not sustainable. And what I find so interesting about it is that dollar in digital ads is basically a dollar spent in hope. Because at least the research that I'm seeing suggests that we don't know if digital advertising works, how it works, under what circumstances it works. And so it's really hard to build what we tend to call a systematic campaign that uses advertising as part of the media mix. Now, to be really fair, we don't have many clues about how advertising as a genre works. I mean, we've got some anecdotes, we've got some for instances, but I think, you know, overall, you'd have to say, apologies to folks in Stratcom, that, you know, do we have a set of rules that we can put down and say, if you do this, 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 and this, your advertising will work? Haven't seen those yet.
Although I must say, there's plenty of evidence that some folks are making a lot of money from digital advertising, Charles, in the search space and just in non-news spaces. Is maybe just newspapers haven't figured out yet how to make money from digital advertising.
I think so. I mean, they're digging the hole as fast as they can, and the faster they dig the one hole, they're filling up the other one. That statistic was truly depressing. And if anybody professes to know the way out within our industries,
give us a call.
Yeah, give us a call.
I do think that there are some newspapers that are trying different things. For example, some American papers are finally starting to charge decent subscription prices, setting up some kinds of paywalls. In Europe, for example, subscription revenue is a lot higher than advertising revenue. We have some papers that are, for example, starting up their own advertising agencies or consulting firms to produce web content or social media for local businesses. So there might be other ways, and let's hope that more than a few newspapers figure out how they get there. Well, that's where we're going to have to leave it for this week. My thanks to Lee and Charles for their perspectives. Also to KBIA's Pat Akers and RJI's Travis McMillan for making the show work again this week. And thanks to you for listening and watching. We'd like to hear more from you, so send us your comments, questions, or topic suggestions to views@kbia.org. Or you can visit our webpage under the Talk Shows tab at kbia.org. That's where you'll also find story links, audio, and video related to each week's program. I'm Mike McKean. Please join Charles, Lee, and me again next Wednesday for another edition of KBIA's Views of the News.